Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my conversation with author, activist, and the new dean of the Claire Trevor School of the Arts at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Tiffany Lopez. We discuss Dr. Lopez's journey from being a first-generation college student to becoming a leading voice in the fight for diversity and inclusion in both higher education and the arts. This episode is packed with inspiring insights, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Dr. Tiffany Lopez, is a visionary who has dedicated her life to increasing opportunities in higher education and furthering the role of the arts through the works as a theater artist, an author, and a scholar. As the granddaughter of migrant farm workers and a first-generation college student, Dr. Lopez knows firsthand the obstacles and challenges faced by many students from underrepresented communities. Dr. Lopez's path to becoming the new dean of the Claire Trevor School of the Arts was not an easy one. Dr. Lopez faced adversity during her childhood and made the difficult decision to leave home at the age of 15. As a teenager, she worked full-time at fast food restaurants while still attending high school. Through her grit and gumption, she went on to complete high school and was encouraged to attend community college. Impressively, she earned her bachelor's, master's, and a PhD at prestigious public universities throughout California. So her return to the University of California system brings her story full circle. However, for many of the Freedom Writers, Dr. Lopez is perhaps best known as the author of Growing Up Chicana, Chicano, an exquisite edited collection of 20 stories by Chicano authors that explore their search for identity in America. Dr. Lopez's book had such a profound impact on my original Freedom Writers that Maria actually referenced the book in Diary 103 in the Freedom Writers Diary. Maria went on to write, "But Ms. Gruwell kept drilling into my head that it doesn't matter where I come from or the color of my skin. She even gave me the book called Growing Up Chicano about people who look like me, but made it out of the ghetto." She goes on to lovingly write a poem about her empowerment called They Say, I Say, in tribute to Dr. Lopez's book, Growing Up Chicano. I'm so honored to welcome Dr. Tiffany Lopez to the Freedom Writers Podcast during Hispanic Heritage Month. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Lopez. For our listeners today, you might sense a giddiness of a teenager. And you're going to get Erin Gruwell at 18, because I am in my old stomping grounds in a big fancy office directly across from the dorms I lived in at University of California, Irvine. And so I feel like I'm 18 years old. So what better way to have our guests share the virtues of education than to have the newly minted dean of the School of the Arts at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Tiffany Lopez. She is an author extraordinaire. Her life's mission has been in the arts, in film, documentaries, independent films, short films, and molding young minds to use arts to find their best self, their authentic self. So, Dean Tiffany Lopez, I'm so excited to be at my alma mater with you before all of the students arrive. Thank you for hosting us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my total pleasure. And the fandom is mutual.
When I first met Dr. Lopez, I literally squealed like a teenager because many of you know Maria, the character Ava in the feature film Freedom Writers. When she was a senior in high school, I got a book and I handed it to her, and the cover said, Growing Up Chicana, Chicano. And I handed it to Maria, and I wanted her to find herself in this book. And it's your book. And she quoted your book, Growing Up Chicana, Chicano, in her diary entry in the Freedom Writer's Diary. So what is that like to know that you had this incredible impact on an original Freedom Writer who many see as the storyteller of our story?
It's always incredibly emotional when you find out the impact you've had on people, because as an artist, as a writer, as a creator, as a teacher, often the impact happens outside the frame, right? You set free the work. And it's pretty rare when you get a story coming back to you where you hear about that impact. Sometimes you can see it directly in the classroom, but often the impact, people have to go down their path, and then you hear about how the work set them on the path or helped them make sense of things that they were working to connect in the moment that you don't get to witness. So hearing that story about Maria is just incredibly powerful.
Yeah. And I think for Maria, she's so excited to meet you in person because, like Anne Frank, you were her muse. So I just am so excited for the two of you to come together and have this kismic moment.
I'm so looking forward to it.
So before you were a dean, before you were a doctor, you were Tiffany. And I want for our listeners who are around the globe to know what young Tiffany was like, because I think your trajectory to being a dean and being a doctor is so inspiring and also obtainable if people do the work, because you're all about doing the work, the sweat equity.
Well, one of the things I really emphasize in my work, whether it's in my work as a dean or my work as a professor, a teacher in the classroom, is the two most important tools our students bring into the realm of our work together is their vision and voice. And how important it is to have the students understand. You could study different disciplines, you can read and focus on different specific things, but the most important tool that you bring to the table is an awareness that your vision and your voice, that they are everything. They're the lens from which you're going to absorb everything, and you should be really confident about the uniqueness of your vision and voice, but the importance of it, because that's the way that you're going to share with others how to see the world.
Did Tiffany at 15 have a vision? And did Tiffany have a voice at 15?
Well, I think we all have a vision and voice. I think it's being confident and being self-aware of what your vision and voice is. I left home at 15. I grew up in a very turbulent, chaotic home with a lot of disruption and violence. My father was a very violent alcoholic. He was a functioning alcoholic, very charming, dynamic person. So really the confusion of witnessing someone who can be very capable and together and impactful in one realm and then another realm be a completely different person. And it's very destructive when you have somebody mixing love and violence together. That does a lot of long-term damage, I think, for young people. They're very confusing to navigate. And then I had a mother who really suffered from a lot of depression and mental illness because of being in that environment. And neither of my parents had a college-level education. And so they're very working-class people carrying their own histories of trauma and violence, you know, physical violence, but also I think poverty is a form of trauma and violence. So carrying that as well from generational poverty on both sides of the family. You don't understand that growing up. You're just trying to navigate what is happening to survive. And so at 15, I woke up one day and my father has left. He was involved with somebody else in an extramarital affair and had decided to just abandon his family. He didn't want to financially take care of his family. My mother wasn't working and he let all the utilities go out and my mother had no idea what to do. And I woke up one day, we were living in Northern California. It was very cold in the winter. And I woke up one day and witnessed my mother heating water in the fireplace. And I said, "What?" And no lights are on, nothing. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she says, "Oh, I'm heating water so you kids can wash up before you go to school." So that I just remember seeing that thinking, there is nothing right about this, and there is no way I can come home to more of this. I was the oldest. I'm about 5 and 6 years older than my younger siblings. I went to school. Of course, I was never sharing with anybody anything that was going on in my family, because you grow up learning that you don't share what's happening in your family with anybody else. You put on a face and you're a different person when you leave your home. So I went to school. I had one very close friend whose family is very solidly middle class, somebody I trusted. And I told her about it. And she said, you've got to tell my father. I don't know what to tell you to do, but I think my father could help you figure out what to do. And so through her trust, I trusted her father. And he was like, you've got to call Children Protective Services. You need to do these things. You can stay with us as long as you need to, but we don't want to get involved with your family, but you could stay with us. So that was the path I took. That was a very emotional and difficult thing to do as a young person. My father, being an alcoholic, had really alienated everyone in his family and moved us from Southern California, where we'd been in connection with our family, to Northern California, where we didn't know anyone. And
it's a form of abuse, manipulation, and isolation.
Exactly. So perpetrating that and imposing that on young people. So at 15, you're kind of, now in hindsight, when I see 15-year-olds, I think, I was a girl, you know, I was a child. But when you grow up in that environment that people call parentified, like you've been made into a little parent, somebody who's going to be the sober one in that dynamic. The most I could do was figure out how to create an intervention. And then I was left to figure out, what am I going to do? And so I was lucky. I had a place to stay with my friend, and her family was like, you're going to have to do something to keep busy. And I started working full time in a fast food restaurant. And you can imagine, I came to school completely exhausted, but school was like the only other sense of community that I had. So I kept going, even though I was sleeping in class all the time and being a terrible student. And I was very, very lucky to have teachers who said, look, we can clearly see something is going on in your life, and the only thing we ask of you is that you keep showing up. Like, even if you're falling asleep in the back of the room, keep showing up. You're not going to understand this now. It'll make sense to you later, but you need to have a high school diploma in hand. You know, even if you graduate with a D minus, like you need to have that. Just keep coming. So that's what I did.
I'm sitting across from you, and you are so elegant and exquisite. And yet I'm envisioning 15-year-old Tiffany, because I have a picture of a 15-year-old Tiffany beside me. And there's tears welling in my eyes. And I just keep thinking of the cadence of brave and bold. That 15-year-old Tiffany was so brave, because in Latina homes, traditionally, the female is not supposed to say anything. And if you see something, you suppress it. And often there's that male hierarchy of the patriarch. So for you to make a call to Child Protective Services probably went against everything that you were taught in the home to be a secret bearer, to stifle that shame. And I'm so proud of you, that 15-year-old Tiffany, to be bold and to be brave. Did you think you were bold and brave at 15?
No. Like I said, you don't think about your vision and voice, and you just don't think about yourself in those ways. I think now I reflect back on it and see that. But at that time, you're just trying to get by. You're trying to figure out your path. You're trying to survive it. I often say the arts saved my life. In the middle of all those experiences and growing up, I was lucky to grow up in California in the 1970s, when there were a lot of free public arts programs. So no matter how much we were financially struggling as a family, there would be a brightness out in the public world. So we could go to a library and there would be, you know, somebody there reading books. There would be crazy book programs in your school where if you received X amount of credits for great behavior, you would get to choose a book and buy a Scholastic book on the book order. I mean, so I didn't have
a library at home. So those books that I would occasionally get to buy meant so much because they were things that I chose, right? You'd look at that and a teacher would give you a catalog and you'd choose a story that spoke to you. So it meant so much. It was like an exercise in creativity and choice. And then, you know, you would have visiting college students who would be on tour with some play or something that they wrote and come and do something in your gym. And it'd be like rock stars were visiting you. You'd just be so inspired by it. And then, of course, there was television and movies and things that you would be exposed to. So I think all of those things, I never thought, wow, art is happening, right? Because we didn't go to museums, but of course, art is everywhere. I would show up in the park, we'd have artists teach you how to make little god's eyes or macrame or whatever was big with the visiting artists at that time. But what art teaches you is the process of making choices, the process that the broken is part of putting things together, and it recovers what violence takes away, which is your sense of voice, your sense that somebody is there witnessing your process, and your right to think about your body and making choices. Art organically sparks all of those things. So I think having those seeds of art, when I came to those crossroads between 15 and 20, between leaving home and getting on a path to go to college, art just began to inspire me and activate my curiosity and my exploration and my trust that this thing that I felt was broken, my family, that I could put things together. As a young Latina girl, here I am reading stories saying, I grew up in the middle of the backwoods in the 1950s as a young boy skipping stones. Art puts you in the heart of stories that you adopt from different points of view. They're not necessarily you. It's not you, but it's also you. You can see things that you might not see for yourself. So art had planted those seeds that when different things got activated through teachers or community mentors or my own studies, those seeds were there to blossom into something.
Both you and I are products of public education, and we both have given back to public education. And I think you are an example of when it's done right. So how does it make you feel when they try to take away the arts from schools and they try to defund the arts whenever there's a financial crisis? Because it seems as if art was your savior and it was your lifeline.
I think that that's precisely why I'm doing what I'm doing right now, is I feel like the arts are needed now more than ever before. And I feel very blessed to be dean of the Claire Trevor School of the Arts here at UC Irvine. It's a double homecoming because I'm a UC alum. I'm also a native of Southern California and in the heart of Orange County and all its different populations. I could be doing a lot of things, and being right here right now is the most important thing I feel that I could be doing, because you can see through TikTok and all the content creation young people are doing, though art may be defunded or not fully funded, nevertheless, the art is an incredible catalyst and engine for building community and sparking learning and creativity. It's irrepressible. So I feel like what we're experiencing right now, there's a lot of things we're experiencing right now in the culture that's showing the push in the pool of where people want to be collectively, their sense of community. And the art is an incredibly powerful engine for people, whether or not it's fully funded or, you know, in my experience, something you're fully cognizant about, it's an anchor in almost all of our lives right now, from what we wear to what we watch to what we're consuming on these devices that are now grafted into our hands 24/7. Art is everywhere. So I feel like the real excitement of our time is a self-consciousness and intentionality and embrace of the importance of the arts in connection with all we do. So here at UC Irvine, what I think is really powerful is you have a school of the arts at a campus with an incredible medical school, incredible number of schools around science and technology.
A shout out to humanities, which was my resting spot here.
And humanities and social ecology and social and behavioral sciences, these are all directly adjacent and in tandem to what we do in the arts. And then part of the shell of coming out to the entire campus. And it's incredible to think about, through the arts, students being able to think about being content creators and makers for e-games, being able to think about tracks to develop artists in residence for hospitals and medical care, being able to be videographers and filmmakers and other cinematic and digital storytellers, working with industry and company who want their own in-house filmmakers and storytellers and content creators. And then, of course, thinking about the way that art and technology can be a really important part of healing, like for people making prosthetics, having sensors attached to music so that as people learn to adapt with their prosthetics, they can more quickly adapt because they're getting a musical feedback. The musicality delivers the movement smoother and more melodious as you learn how to adapt the prosthetic. There's just so many different incredible parts of what we would call the creative economy, and so much of the work that's grounded around the arts as an incredible tool and incredible part of being able to work technology and science, and this generation is going to invent careers that we don't even know how to name right now. They're going to make those pathways in the arts. I think the goal is that self-reflectiveness and consciousness about vision and voice, so that this generation can think about art not as a fluffy side thing, or as that you're either on a path to become a specific kind of maker, a musician, a fine artist, a playwright, a dancer. Those things will always be in place, and those things are also tools to collaborate in other ways. And we want to uplift students to see that the way that they have agility in science and STEM, that they have agility in the arts, and those are viable tools and pathways to have incredible careers of their making, but also careers that they don't necessarily know about, and that the college is here to help unlock the pathways to explore and develop. And this is, you know, to talk about the vision and voice. As a young person, I would have never thought, oh, where you came from, your story of what you survived and the path that you went through to bring your vision and voice. Everything I've just shared with you comes from my own personal story, is understanding the power of the art to help you heal. And I think sometimes when we have stories of people who have survived extraordinary traumas, the narrative we have is, oh my gosh, this traumatic thing happened in their life and look at how they survived it. But there's the chapter two after that part of the story, which is they go on to have lives that are filled with joy and impact and making meaning in all kinds of ways. And I think that's the story that I'm able to share is, yes, I survived these very difficult things, and they become part of my vision and voice to help others to find how they're going to survive, but how they're going to have that next incredible chapter to develop really this extraordinary life in which the sense of what you feel right now is being broken, you will pull that together to make this incredible piece of art that is you, that you will put out into the world.
Well, speaking of chapters, I have beside me your book. And I want to talk about that next chapter, that you were 15 and you made this brave and bold decision that education and art was going to be your salvation. And what I love about being at UC Irvine is this is one of the colleges that has the most first-generation college students attending this university. So that's really exciting, specifically in the Latino community. So kudos to this university and having the vision to open up its doors and really say, this is a home. But between 15 and 20, you had to make a decision about your life. Will I follow in the footsteps of my mother, who didn't have a career, who didn't go to college, or am I going to go to college? And I don't have that blueprint in my family. So let's go back for all of those middle school and high school listeners right now who are a little Tiffany. What was that path like for you from that 15 to 20 to say education and the arts is my career?
Yeah, there's a lot of different stones on that footpath. So I love that you're inviting me to think about talking to that younger person, because I know that my story isn't particularly unique. I think the way I navigated my story, the way I'm able to tell the story, is what's unique. So to the many of you out there listening who feel very connected to this story, know that you have not just myself, but many others there to help you. It was through my work. I loved the sense of community, and I loved working in the fast food restaurant where I was working. And I started moving my way up from just working the line or cashiering to being a trainer, like training employees on how to do that job. And then eventually I moved into a management role where I was training people on how to open new fast food restaurants.
While you're in high school?
Yes. So at that time, I'm working full time while I'm in high school. And it's probably towards the end of my senior year when I'm in that kind of a level.
So you're working 40 hours plus being a full-time student.
Yes, but being a full-time student, I was a full-time failing student, because how can you do both of those things well? But I had promised my teachers no matter what, I would just keep coming to class. So I was going to school during school hours, and then I was leaving at 3 or 4 and going to work 4 to midnight and going home and getting a nap and going back to school and getting some more sleep at school and then going to work. So that was really what that looked like. But my energy and the sense of bringing myself was most activated at work. So I developed a dream that maybe one day I might want to become a fast food franchisee. Maybe I might want to own a restaurant, not just want to work in a restaurant. And the franchisee I worked for said, you're going to need some college for that, at least an associate's degree in business. You should start going to community college. So I was definitely out of high school at that point, because I was able to start going to community college.
And while you're working 40 hours a week,
yes,
were you sharing any of the funds with your siblings or your mother?
No, I was completely estranged from my family at that point.
Did they feel that you had deserted them? Did they feel that you had broken this family secret?
Yeah. I mean, my father, when I left home, he had called me and said that if he ever saw me again, he'd kill me. So he made death threats that I believed. And then
you were a sophomore in high school at this time.
I was still, yeah, a young person in high school. And it was chilling and very upsetting. And then my siblings, they were so young. They eventually were taken out of the home with my mother. But my mother was so unwell, and my father was a chameleon, right? As many alcoholics are, able to get very sober at will and become very lucid and convincing to people. And in the face of a woman who's very broken, my father had custody of my younger brother and sister. It's very heartbreaking to think as a young person that you don't have a lot of choices of impact, that you've done the best you could. In my life, I'm very optimistic and very visionary. I think about the long game and the big picture, but I'm also very pragmatic. I think growing up in those circumstances, it makes you think about pragmatically, what can you actually do? And so when I left home, pragmatically, I was like, well, I've got to figure out, I don't want the path of either of my parents. What can I do? I can think about, this might be a viable career that I could develop as quickly as possible, maybe be in my 20s and own a restaurant and create some kind of financial stability and life for myself. So it was with that framework of thinking that I started going to community college. And it was there that everything changed, because, of course, part of your associate's degree is you aren't just studying business, you're in composition courses that you with on writing, and then you choose electives. And what were the electives I chose? Photography, creative writing. I chose the arts as my electives and quickly discovered it took me 3 times to even remotely pass statistics. But I had immediately in the small community college I was at, had my arts and humanities faculty pull me aside and say, you know, you have a lot of talent, and we all happened to be talking in the break room and discovered that you're a shared student. We've all been talking about you, and we think it's time for you to think about transferring. And I said, transferring? Transfer where? I did not understand an associate's degree was different from a bachelor's degree or going to a community college or a Cal State or a University of California or Stanford. Those are just education. I didn't understand the distinctions between any of them because no one in my family had been in college, but no one in high school had even thought I was college material. They were just trying to help me get through. So just by showing up and bringing my passion, my vision and voice, and being very into what I was doing as part of this bigger picture of getting an AA degree, that people saw things that I couldn't see for myself. And I think I needed a sense of community. I needed a sense of parental figures in my life, that when these professors showed care and told me what they saw for me, I embraced that. So one of the professors who I had a crush on, in hindsight, I didn't want to date this person. I wanted to be this person. But he had suggested, he said, look, I'm an adjunct professor at the California State University. If you transfer, I think you have the capacity to be an English major. If you transfer, I will tell you what professors to study with. I'll help you figure out financial aid. I'll put you in connection with all these programs. And at that time, it was the last wave of affirmative action. And what that means is people were looking for first-gen Latino students because they realized California's future needed leaders, right? Whether you were going to be a business leader, an educator, or whatever, they needed an educated workforce for the future of California's economy. So that brought that attention and people putting me into programs. And the programs are very important because they're run by people who understand the kinds of paths and the questions and the knowledge that first-gen students need to get through the college experience, in addition to just being a great student. And in addition to that, really thinking about the programs are a really important part of that.
You're a poet. I have a picture of you in your college years of your poetry phase, but your cadence and the figurative language you use when you speak is making this English teacher just giddy. But I talked about being bold and brave earlier. I think you also have like the grit and the gumption because you did the work and you did the dissertation. You are the doctoral candidate, and then you write this amazing book that had a profound impact on me as a novice teacher who was just trying to reach students like the ones you described. I didn't know your backstory to that extent, but I wanted my students to use voice and vision. I wanted my students to think about higher education. I wanted my students to have the grit and the gumption that you had. So talk about your passion project of growing up Chicana and growing up Chicano, not knowing that it would impact teachers like me and the vulnerable students that I humbly served.
Yeah, that's another stepping stone. So when I went to California State University, Sacramento, one of the mentors that I was put in touch with was a Chicana English professor, Olivia Castellano, who's a poet and among the first in her generation to have a master's degree in literature from Stanford. And she's a poet and really a beautiful person, incredible poet, and deeply involved in Sacramento's art scene. There's another poet, Jose Montoya, who's also a renowned visual artist. But those are two of the core ones who were also on faculty at Cal State. And so Olivia Castellano brought me into the fold, took me to poetry readings. She brought guest writers to coming to campus. So it was there that I met and worked with Rudolfo Anaya, the author of Bless Me Ultima. It was also there that I met an upcoming luminary, a young writer by the name of Sandra Cisneros, who had just published The House on Mango Street.
Which I taught both of these books. So I'm just, the hairs on my arms are standing up for the audience at home.
And then it was also there where I was invited to be part of staged poetry readings and meeting not only Sandra Cisneros, but another up-and-coming young writer named Ana Castillo. So here I am in my 20s meeting these people who are a little farther ahead of myself, very clearly on the path of harnessing their vision and voice into their craft as very intentionally design-minded visionary writers. So I was so inspired. And so I started to write poetry and short stories. I aspired to become a Sandra Cisneros. She was a hugely impactful meeting her as a young person and getting to take writing workshops with her and then witnessing her journey from having just published House on Mango Street to seeing what next. I got to see in the glow of what was her next and how she was sharing drafts from My Wicked, Wicked Ways and Woman Hollering Creek. So the literature is alive for me. The Chicano muralist art making scene is alive for me. I'm witnessing it. I'm involved in it. Then Olivia said, Mija, I've got to know when I leave this world, there'll be at least one other Chicana English professor, and it's going to be you. I've never sent someone forward to have a master's or a PhD, and that's going to be you. I felt knighted, honored, inspired that I was going to be a keeper of the legacy that was so impacting me, because it was all the stories no one in my family could ever tell. And here I was witnessing this generation of writers who had dedicated themselves to telling the stories of their parents who were migrant farm workers and of, you know, as Sandra Cisneros and Ana Castillo do, of the trauma and the generational violence and how people work through it in ways that are both beautiful and bold and brave, showing the beauty of that as well as the crisis points. So I was so inspired. I wanted to go to graduate school. And that was going to be my research, because I could talk about being in it and document it. And my friend Jorge Huerta, who's a foundational figure of Chicano theater, and I'm a theater scholar by training, he says, things don't exist if they're not documented in history. It's like as if they never happened. So I wanted to document the work as well as make the work. So I entered my studies as a creator critic, as a creative artist, and a scholar. I've always been that hybrid person. So when I got to graduate school, I'm, you know, working on a PhD, I'm writing literature, I'm meeting a lot of different people. And William Morrow had this series, the Growing Up series. They reached out to Rudolfo Anaya and they said, we want to have the edited collection, Growing Up Chicana Chicano, and we would like it to be edited and pulled together by somebody who grew up with the literature, who was impacted by it. And Rudy said, I know the person. I'll put you in touch with her. So I talked with the press, and they got very excited. And I'm younger than 25 when I get approached with the book contract. I'm still doing graduate work, and it became one of the most extraordinary things. And so the way that I put together the anthology was really thinking about what are the stories that most impacted me as a young person. Never in my grade school experience or middle school or high school had I ever been given anything to read by an author with a Z in their last name or who is Mexican American or even talked about the Mexican American experience or history or culture. So here you are in California, you're reading streets that have Spanish names, you're experiencing things like fiesta days and food festival. Like, we're completely artistically and culturally immersed in Latino culture in California, yet the literature, the parts that really taking you deep into the history and people's experiences, isn't part of the public education system. So putting together the book, it was really important to me to share the stories that had impacted me, but also to add the stories that as an artist and as a critic, I thought were really important for young people to be exposed to for a lot of different reasons. And when I edited the anthology, the first author I approached was Sandra Cisneros, and I wanted to put 11 in there because I think that that's just such a powerful story poetically. Once Sandra said yes, everyone else I approached said yes. And then there's a couple of stories in there that were by writers that had disappeared, had dropped off the radar, that people couldn't find. And I was very fortunate in the Arte Público Press helped me gain permissions.
We started out talking to a young Tiffany, an audience member who may or may not be 15, who may or may not have had the same journey as you. Now I want you to picture a work in progress, and it may be a freshman who shows up this fall at this fine university, and I want you to envision speaking to them the way your mentor spoke to you. And what would you say to a work in progress?
That it's completely possible. Think more about what is possible and about your vision and voice, like why you want to do this, because the how of getting it done will happen. But I think the most important thing is thinking about the possible, what it is that you want to do, what your vision and voice is, what you see in your future, and to really not get sucked into the undertow of discourse that is negative or trying to have you think more about what the roadblocks are, what can't be done, because you can get through all of those things. I think that that's what I'm a living testimony about, is I didn't grow up with cell phones or a lot of media talking in my ear all the time. I think it's an incredible thing. Young people have instant access to all kinds of knowledge and information, but that also means that you have a constant barrage of people imposing their thoughts on you. And a lot of those thoughts are around what can't be done or what's going to be risky or hazardous or potentially insurmountable, igniting a lot of fear and caution. I was lucky in that I was free to think about what I really wanted to do and how to get it done and make it happen. And I was very lucky to have teachers and mentors who said, I don't have the answers, you don't have the answers, but here's all the resources you need to connect with. They will help you get down that path. And that's what happened. I took out a lot of student loans. Now, if as a young 20-something-year-old, I had told somebody, oh, I'm going to take out tens of thousands of dollars to invest in property in California, people would have said, you should do this. Yes. I saw that my student loans were buying a house in my head. And I had real confidence that that was going to be the most important investment in my life that would pay off infinitely into the future. And that was because I had two parents who didn't go to college. And it wasn't just the degree, it was that they didn't have skills. They didn't have critical thinking skills. They didn't have professional training skills. They didn't have skills of being able to self-reflect and think about their life. I might not have phrased it that way in my 20s, but I intuited that that college would give me those skills. And then when I went to graduate school, I thought, I don't know about this PhD thing, but I do know that it gives me access to mental health care. And if the only thing I leave 5 years of graduate school with is the fact that I had 5 years of mental health care to help me get better and recover from trauma, then that will have been worth it. This was before having the risk of something that is going to talk to me and tell me things in my life on a daily basis that I didn't necessarily invite into my life, right? You know, our devices are telling us stuff all the time that we aren't necessarily saying, hey, I'd like to know about this. The majority of what our devices are telling us is it's imposing on us, and the algorithms, you know, do it even more in a package of making us think, oh, these are things that are great. You know, it's following who I am and what I like, but it's also telling you things that you don't necessarily want or need to hear at a certain time. And that's a lot of energy to parse through that. That wasn't energy I had to spend in my life. So I was able to think about what was possible rather than the roadblocks. So I applied really rigorously for fellowships and scholarships. Now, I don't know if most students are aware, but there's a lot of money that goes unclaimed that's earmarked for fellowships and scholarships, and simply because students haven't applied for it. One of the most important lessons from my mentors was having me think about all the resources that were available for me to tap into at college. And most importantly, to understand that being in the classroom and taking a class, that was just one part of being a college student. The university is an amazing resource. If you're only going to class and studying, it's like only using 5% of your brain. It's like, it's one part of the resource of the university. I think because I thought about investing in myself, like that my college loan was part of investing in myself, I was like, and what more is there? Okay, my mentors and teachers are telling me, wow, I could get resources about fellowships and scholarships. I could get resources and fellowships about internships and jobs. But the other most important resource was the one I shared earlier, which is the impact resource. Taking the time to go meet writers and artists and attend a lecture. And now people can do that so much easier through the realm of Zoom and do it immediately. But I think most students, they think college is just about taking a bunch of classes and getting a degree. And it's about so much more, including your own healing. Like, there's mental health care at the university. Now, I don't want to paint a totally rosy picture because the landscape can be difficult to navigate. And that's where I think that knowing, keep your focus on what you want to do, why you're there, and the bigger picture and end game, it'll get you through those moments. You know, we hear a lot in the public discourse right now about student loan debt. That's just like a huge noise, I think, for young people that's preventing them to think about what's possible going to college and how it will really change your life. And you are investing in yourself. So I don't want to encourage everyone to take on the kinds of student loans I took on because it took me into my 40s to pay them off. But with my doctorate, it's completely made it that I don't have a ceiling on what I can do in my life. Right. I remember boohooing at a certain point to someone going, oh, I have this doctorate in English. Does it mean I can only be an English professor? And he worked for a high tech firm. And he said, no, it means that you're a super learner and you have people skills and communication skills and art making skills. If you wanted to work for our company, we know we could put you in a room for 6 months and tell you to learn something and you'd come out the other end and be able to do it.
So in closing, having somebody come at the other end, I envisioned at some point that one of my students would look to a doctor, now Dean, Tiffany Lopez, and say, I look like her. I talk like her. I come from where she comes from, and I want to be her. What does that mean to you? To look like, talk like, come from, and be to all of the sweet Tiffany Lopez's, near and wide. How could we include them in this trajectory?
I think the journey I've had in life is to just be your authentic self and trust in the process of your journey. Because people who see me now, I always tell my story to students, but I'll reveal my story because I want young people to understand it's a process to get to where I'm at. It's messy, it's ugly, it's complicated, it has its failings. At the same time, they are what we call in the arts rehearsal. iteration. So even a lot of the talking points I'm sharing with you today, they're not just off the top of my head. These are things I've been talking about for a while. And the way I'm sharing it with you right now, that's the art making. That's the beautiful part. I've never pulled these things together. And there's new things that I'm sharing with you that I've never shared in another conversation before. But it doesn't just pop out of thin air. That's why I shared the pictures with you, is you can see the stress I'm wearing on my face in high school. You can see in college when I'm trying to be a young poet, how I'm trying something on. It's a little not fully authentic. There's a posing there. And that's okay, because as a young person, you're trying things. The big thing is that you always keep your path moving forward. I wasn't the most brilliant student, but I was the one with forward momentum that just kept going forward. And I remember when I took my PhD exam, somebody said to me, there's a hoop. You do not have to jump through the hoop and that the hoop looks intact. You can get through the hoop and bust and break and bend the sides. You just have to get through the hoop. And then I remember there was a point in my life where I was in therapy and really upset and wondering if I could get through, become a professor. And I remember the therapist I saw at the time said, if the university is a dinner table, how big is that dinner table? I said, it's infinite in all directions. There's no boundary to it. And the person looked at me and said, then that means there's a chair at that table for you. So that would be the message that I would say to the young person. It's going to be messy. It's not going to be perfect. There's going to be brokenness. But the lesson that artists teach us is that is part of the process. And it doesn't have to all make sense to you right now, but it will later. It will all add up to something.
I'm so grateful to Dr. Lopez for sharing her story with us and for her dedication to increasing opportunities for students from underrepresented communities. My dear listeners, may we all pursue our dreams with passion, determination, and tenacity. May each of us find ways to use our creativity to make meaningful change in the world. And in honor of today's guest, Dr. Tiffany Lopez, may we all find our vision and use our voices to make a difference. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you for being part of the Freedom Writer family. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruo. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.